Good morning, friends. I feel like every time I get invited to speak here, I just need to prepare for the fact that because God really loves you guys, I'm going to get wrecked, okay? So that's just how he does this. I have spent quite a number of hours writing a sermon this week. You're welcome. Prepared, studied, wrote, tore it up. Wrote again. This is a process. And I went digging through my bag, and guess what's not in there? My sermon is not in my bag. And I was like, right. And then as we're worshiping, the Lord instead gives me a word. And I don't mean like, thus says the Lord. That's what I mean. I mean literally a single word. I'm like, that's not a sermon, God. That's a word. And he gives me a word. So I'm going to give you that word, and then we're just going to leave, okay? don't you wish that was the case? Y'all ready for this word? It's a doozy. You ready? I didn't make this word up, I promise. Actually, it was made up by a person much smarter than me. The word is eucatastrophe. You heard this word before? I didn't think so. I was like, Lord, you're just going to make me look like a nerd again. That's what you're going to do. And he's like, yeah, of course I am. That's what we do. All right. So let's talk about this bizarre word, eucatastrophe. Everybody knows what a catastrophe is, right? Yeah. And it's interesting because this is how language works, just so you know. We start off with an idea. And then we try to like understand the idea in a bunch of different ways. And one of the ways that we define things is by giving its opposite, right? So like the word catastrophe is a Greek word, right? No, we don't know that, but we kind of assume, right? I know that. Michael knows that. Nerd. Come from two Greek words. Kata. Catastrophe. Shocking, right? Catastrophe. And it has to do with the negation of something. So you have something that's kind of ordered and going along in the way it should be. And then life happens. Or death. Right? Chaos comes in and it like messes it all up. And it's a catastrophe. So in literature, especially in the ancient world, they would write stories around catastrophe. And catastrophe would be the turning point in the story from when things were going really well to what? Things becoming a mess. And that genre of storytelling is called tragedy. And we all actually enjoy reading or watching or experiencing in story, a good tragedy. Like it does something in us. We're like, oh, yeah, that seems about right. And you cry, and then you feel better, right? Catastrophe. We also know the other thing, the other kind of literature, where it goes the other way, right? Where everything actually starts out a mess, and then there's a turning point, and everything comes back together, and it's good. That genre of storytelling is called comedy. And it's funny because we think comedy and we think funny. Because when we do humor, we can actually have dark comedy, which is really based on tragedy, and then you have traditional comedy, which is the turning point is to the good. I promise I'm going to get to the Bible. I swear, it's not a literature class. But I have to get you to this understanding because it's what the Lord gave me. Comedy, we look for that moment for the turn, and it also elevates us. But we do find humor in it because it's always unexpected. It's as unexpected as the catastrophe, the turn to good. So like some of the most famous stories that we call comedies, like you like read in literature in like Shakespeare. And it starts off, and there's twins, but they've been separated at birth, and they end up in the same city. And you can imagine, they're both slaves. And so their masters get them confused. And all of the chaos that ensues from the confusion. And it starts off as a mess. Like the opening scene is a mess. And it gets messier and messier and messier until the revelation of what's happened and actually good comes out of it. But the mess and the turn delight the heart of the reader. We resonate with this. It's the opposite of catastrophe. So J.R.R. Tolkien, y'all know who this guy is, J.R.R. Tolkien? It's another nerd thing, okay? Lord of the Rings, it's a story. He was a medieval scholar, a Christian, or a medievalist. He didn't live in the Middle Ages, studied the Middle Ages. He wrote a story, a fantasy story. And many of us have seen the movies, many of us have read the books. And basically, he tells a story of the world is under a growing threat of evil. And when it seemed its darkest, there was only one slim hope. And as you get closer and closer to that time when that hope gets slimmer and slimmer, it seems utterly impossible. It's all falling apart. It can't happen. And then you catastrophe strikes. And the word is actually coined by Tolkien. He was writing on fairy stories. And he says, you catastrophe is at the heart of any good fairy story, where everything is going to fall apart. There is literally no real possibility of change. The world is utterly dark. And even if we get saved from this point, it's so dark, it can't really be saved. It can just be not dead. And then something occurs that's so transformative that it turns death on its head and becomes life. And the kind of life that's not just, oh, well, at least we didn't die, but the kind of life that actually turns everything into joy, unspeakable joy, an utter inverse of what we were experiencing, and that is what he defines as eucatastrophe. The little EU at the front just means good. So you take a positive strophe, you negate it with kata, you get catastrophe, and then you negate that with you, and you get the good catastrophe. And he says, this is why fairy stories, fairy tales, are actually powerful, because they tell us that there is actually a way where the stuff that we call evil and dark and destructive and death can not only be avoided, it can be turned toward a good you couldn't even have imagined. Now, why am I preaching on this and not studying like in the Word to say, well, we're going to get there. I do promise you this. Tolkien claims that eucatastrophe is at the heart of the gospel. And the reason that he writes fairy tales is because he said they're the closest thing to truth that we can get to in this world. It's a pretty wild claim. He said it puts the reality we experience in another context so that we can see it in another context and have our eyes opened to its reality so we can turn around and see it in where we are. All right. Let's make a point with this, shall we? Told you I left my sermon at home, guys. I'm sorry. Where are we going? Well, let me give you another example, and then we'll read our text today. Anyone in here ever heard of Dante's Inferno? Yeah? I told you. Sorry, guys, it's a nerd day. I don't know what to tell you. God's like, come on, man, I'm going to lay you out in front of everybody as what you are. All right, Dante's Inferno is the story of one man who finds himself lost in the middle of life, and he was chased. He was being chased by three beasts, is the story. that I find myself in the middle of a dark wood, and all of a sudden he's walking through the woods. You think he's okay. He's kind of miserable because he's lost the person that he loves. She's dead. And then all of a sudden he gets chased by three beasts. And he gets chased by these three beasts, and they're representative of greed, lust, and power, I think. He gets chased all the way, and he's crying out for help, and a helper from heaven comes and says, I'm going to save you. I'm going to help you. I'm going to take you on a journey and rescue you from these beasts. Are you ready? He's like, yes, thank God. I get to go into the presence of God. I'm going to be rescued by heaven. And do you know where they take him? They take him to hell. And he's like, what? All right, I'm not going to go into the whole story. Basically, he begins to descend into hell, and he has to face the reality of sin and the consequence. And he meets people along the way, and they're all talking about the goodness of God and then demonstrating in their own presence the result of sin. The story of the Inferno is the first of three parts. Dante calls the whole thing the Divine Comedy. And you're like, it doesn't sound very funny. It doesn't mean comedy, slapstick, funny. It's the Divine Comedy where there is a turn. What looks like absolute darkness and death has a eucatastrophic end. See, Dante is led down to the depths of hell. It's a terrible time to have a cymbal start going. It gets to the bottom. Satan is at the bottom of hell, upside down. And he has to climb. Think about that. Down. Climbing down. And as he's climbing down, something bizarre happens. He gets to the top of Satan's head, which is the bottom of hell, and he stands up and he finds that he is now on the other side, and his descent has actually been an ascent the entire time. Eucatastrophe. The harrowing of hell in this story, the journey of pain, suffering, facing sin, learning the truth about the ugliness and the cost and the trial and the tribulation is not the pain that God's putting you through as punishment because you deserve punishment. It's actually the path that he has you on to rectify your soul in your journey toward him. Didn't feel like it to Dante. But there was this eucatastrophic moment where everything was changed. So here's my question to you as we get into our text, and it'll be short. Are the things you're experiencing in life that are causing you to question God's goodness, the things you experience in life that are causing you to wonder if you're really in him? Are the sufferings and the pains and the hardship that you for some reason feel like are an attack against you a catastrophe? Or are they God's eucatastrophe in your life as he transforms you through the suffering of Jesus into the image of the glory of God? The passage today is 1 John chapter 3, starting at verse 11. For this is the message you heard from the beginning. We should love one another. Don't be like Cain, who belonged to the evil one and murdered his brother. And why did he murder him? Because his own actions were evil and his brothers were righteous. Don't be surprised, my brothers and sisters, if the world hates you. We know that we have passed from death to life because we love each other. Anyone who does not love remains in death. Anyone who hates a brother or sister is a murderer. And you know that no murderer has eternal life residing in him. This is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us. We ought to lay down our lives for our brothers and sisters. If anyone has material possessions and sees a brother or sister in need but has no pity on them, how can the love of God be in that person? Dear children, let us not love with words or speech, but with actions and in truth. All right, that's the first half of the reading. I got two sections today, and actually there's at least 15 sermons in them. I promise not to preach them all. This first one, honestly, guys, I read these sometimes, and I'm like, I've been trained in reading ancient literature. It's a relatively simple letter, but you read it, and then you ask, if I just asked a question, what does this mean? This seems like a jumbled mess. Y'all know that, right? Like, you're reading it, if you're honest, and you ask, wait a minute, how does he go from this opening, for this is the message you heard from the beginning, we should love one another, and then he goes to, don't be like Cain, who murdered his brother. And you're like, okay, we're going to set the bar kind of low. I mean, y'all know the story of Cain, right? It's pretty simple. Cain's a murderer. So, love each other, don't kill each other. And he's talking like, this is literally, physically what happened. Two brothers have the same father. They also worship the same God. One of them aligns himself with what God wants, and lo and behold, God receives his offering and blesses him. The other guy does things his own way, and lo and behold, God says, nope. And then this brother over here enjoys a right relationship with God. And this brother over here is out of relationship with God. And so this brother looks over there and goes, I want what he has. That's not fair. And he gets angry. But because he's out of relationship with God, his anger does not lead to righteousness. Because the only way to be righteous, by the way, is to be in relationship with God. It's that simple. Because God is real and true and good. And if you're not in relationship with what's real, you're going to view things that's not going to be real. This is unfair. My brother is unjustly receiving a reward that I should get. It's not really what's going on, but Cain believes it because he's not in relationship with truth. And he gets angry. Anger's fine. Anger's the response we have when things are unjust. That's appropriate. God gets angry. The problem is when you are getting angry about a situation, but you don't even know what truth is, you're getting angry at injustice, and you're facing and throwing it the wrong way. It's an utter catastrophe. So Cain does what only Cain knows he can do in that moment, and he's like, I'll fix this. And he kills his brother. Another catastrophe. Especially for the dude who's in relationship with God. You ever think about that? You're like, I know, I'll be in relationship with God and my life will look great. Hey, what happened to the perfect guy? Out of curiosity. Anybody know? The one person has lived life perfectly. What happened to him? He was tortured and died. And then he goes, and this is the way. Not like the Mandalorian, but like the Jesus comment. And he meant it. Because he says, I'm aligning myself with truth. I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am in line with what is. 1 John tells us, when you align yourself with what's true, with love, reality, when you're in right relationship with God, the people who are not in right relationship with God react. And do you know how they react? With murder. Like, let's kind of go extreme on this, shall we? And that's what he says. So he's telling them, like, look, guys, you have been made right with God, and that looks a certain way. Over here, you're surrounded by people who are not right with God, and they're going to dislike that you're right with God because it makes them feel like they're not right. Their whole world feels like it's a mess, and you being in relation with God makes them feel bad. So they fix it, and they kill you. Like, okay, let's explain some things. And then he continues on and says, you, however, need to live right with God. And that looks like you love each other. So the inverse of the killing thing is love leads to life. In fact, the way you do this is you should, like Jesus, freely and willingly lay down your life for your brothers and sisters, which is the opposite of killing them. I know that's really basic, right? Setting the bar low. Don't kill your brother and sister. Give them life. How do I do that? And this is the part where you get a little bit of a you catastrophe. You ready? How did Jesus do that? How did he give life? Remember, he had fullness of life. His relationship with God was perfect. How did he give perfect relationship with God and life to the people who were killing each other? He let them kill him rather than fighting back. He loved them through the suffering they caused so that they might see reality. Real goodness might crash through the bizarre false reality they had created, capture their heart, and transform them into joy. He took death itself and made death the vehicle for life. It's the most eucatastrophic moment in the history of the world. And then he says, not, hey, I've done this, so you're off the hook. This is the part where we go, wait, hold on, stop, pause. I've always heard that Jesus paid for my sins, so I don't have to. And the answer is like, yeah. Jesus paid for your sin so that you can join him in transforming the world his way. What is his way? Well, instead of pursuing life through your false reality and going around and stealing it from everybody, killing as you go, focused on yourself, he says you willingly lay down your life, and it starts in the little tiny things that you experience every day. And he gives us an example. If you see a brother or sister that has a need and you have material possessions, love looks like giving them what they need rather than you holding on to it. He says that's life. That's you laying down your life so that somebody else can live. It's the opposite of death or theft. Taking what you want or feel you deserve from another so that you get and they don't. And John seems to think that these things are actually absolutely intrinsically tied, so that murder and theft are the exact same thing, and generosity and self-sacrifice are the exact same thing. So every moment you have an opportunity to love or hate. You get to either participate in the reality of God, life through the eucatastrophic laying down of your life you live, or you go take what you want, you live it your way and create your own reality, and it's a catastrophe. That's the choice. And so John says very simply, this is the command that you have heard from the beginning. This is the good news and the message. This is the gospel. We should love each other and not kill each other. And you're like, yeah, okay. Tracking so far. It's good. And it looks like Jesus. Yeah, that sounds really good. Have y'all ever seen those movies where it's like Inception or The Matrix, and it's like you break through one level of reality and then you find out that that's not it either. So you break through the next level of reality and you find out that's not it either. So this is interesting. I think, and this is maybe just me, you guys are probably a lot more stable than I am. I'm serious. My life's a mess all the time. Has been. I thought when I got saved that I had experienced my eucatastrophic moment and that life would just kind of be good after that. And I'm when I say this, I'm not lying. I have been pursuing God my whole life. Like I just have. That's been my aim. And yet, every once in a while, it's like someone comes along and pulls a rug out from underneath me and my whole world goes spinning, or I feel like I'm in a snow globe and someone picks it up and just goes, woohoo! Sorry, you were sleeping. I've been teaching high schoolers too long, okay? Forgive me. And I'm like disoriented, and I come to a place where I actually, things settle back down and I get adjusted to the new reality. And what's amazing is it's kind of like this letter that John writes. It's really stupid simple. This is the message you've heard from the beginning. Love each other. And I'm like, I thought I was. And Jesus goes, yeah, I know you did. That's why I shook the snow globe. And I'm like, oh, that was you? I don't like that. That doesn't seem very good. Felt a whole lot like death. Every freaking time. And it usually could have been avoided. Had I known. And Jesus is like, yeah, but you didn't know. I know. And the point is, you have to walk trusting me, and that's what's required of you. And that's the last point today. We're going to read this last section. We're going to end with this, guys. It really is two things. Love each other and trust Jesus. I don't know how much simpler it gets than that. But this is like the most basic passage in the history of the world. He goes from don't kill each other, love each other. Like, okay, I think I got that. And he gets into this. This is how we know that we belong to the truth and how we set our hearts at rest in his presence. If our hearts condemn us, we know that God is greater than our hearts and he knows everything. Dear friends, if our hearts do not condemn us, we have confidence before God and receive from him anything we ask, because we keep his commands and do what pleases him. And this is his command, to believe in the name of his Son, Jesus Christ, and to love one another as he commanded us. The one who keeps God's commands live in him, and he in them. And this is how we know that he lives in us. We know it by the Spirit he gave us. Okay, again, just honestly, I read it and went, really? None of that seems to jive. It doesn't go together. Guys, ancient writing is sometimes difficult. The logical process that we go through in our communication is a different pattern than what they use. Doesn't mean it's not logical, it's just different structure. So you have to learn how to see how they organize their thought to piece it together. So what's he saying? Well, first of all, remember, and I think I mentioned this last time I was here, these people had just gone through a massive split, and the people that left said to the people that remained, you don't really know God. You don't know anything about spiritual life. You're actually not spiritually alive. You're spiritually immature. And you're really kind of pitiful in your morality and trying to live a moral life the way that you are. So here's John saying, hey, let's bring this back. And he says, really, truly, morality boils down to, are you loving or hating? Are you giving life or taking it away? And everything we do can be aligned with that. And he's affirming them in their love for one another and saying, hey, don't believe this group that's out there telling you you aren't spiritually alive. I know you're spiritually alive because you love each other. If you were not spiritually alive, you would be murdering each other. And everyone kind of goes, really? And they're like, yeah, look around. How does the world treat everybody? How are you treating one another? You wouldn't be doing that apart from something that changed you. This second part is all about assurance. Let me assure you, you're alive, not dead. Let me assure you, you have been giving evidence that everything I'm telling you is true. That you're in line with reality. That if the snow globe gets shaken, you get back down to that bottom layer and, oh, Jesus still is the Son of God and the Messiah. If you do that, if you believe, if you trust, you are obedient. That's not you have to be obedient. No, that is obedience. Congratulations, you fulfilled God's command. You have obeyed him. What did he tell you to do? Trust Jesus. Like baseline, guys. This is the eucatastrophic shift. You trust Jesus and not yourself. You don't do what Cain did and look at Abel and be like, I want what he has. I'm going to go make myself right by killing that guy. Instead, we're like, no, I'm going to trust that Jesus has made me right. And I'm going to then live that way. Which leads us to the second thing, which is kind of back to the first thing. And what's it look like to live that way? And he goes, love each other. You have the Spirit of God in you. You now are aligned with truth. You now are empowered to love each other, to give life instead of taking. Which means if someone in your community has a need, you get to meet that need. Without any thought, fear, concern, just meet the need. Give what you've got. Why? Because, well, Jesus has saved you. And that's what you do. And it plays out in every decision that you make. And if the enemy comes along and the world comes along and starts shaking your snow globe up, you get to trust that that truth is utterly assured. And all it will do is reaffirm in you that you are actually living in the real world. And everything else that gets busted up when that shake happens that you thought was real can be realigned. But if you put your faith in Jesus and you live a life that loves others, that continues to be the real world that God has made and that he's remaking and that he's asked you to join him in living in. the eucatastrophic moment of the cross is the new reality. And it's not something that we hate and run from and fear. But we're invited to embrace, pursue, and walk, knowing that it will be flipped on its head at the return of Jesus into joy unspeakable. The laughter that will come from our hearts at the return of Jesus. Not laughter because what a mess that was, but laughter like, I can't even fathom the goodness that he just brought out of just disaster. So here's what I want you to do with this today. I want you to look at your life. Think about it for a minute. I want you to ask the Spirit to reveal to you where he's inviting you to view difficulty, suffering, hardship, and pain as a potential eucatastrophic moment by participating with Jesus, and turn instead turn to faith and recognize that it's an invitation. It's not proof that God doesn't love you. It's an invitation by God's love to participate in the work that he's doing through Jesus. And then I want you to turn around and take that power, which because it changes what you can do. If you are defeated by your circumstances, you are powerless. If you look at your circumstances as participating in the victory of Jesus, you are empowered to love people through that pain. I just want you to ask, because I don't have the wisdom to tell you what it looks like. I can barely figure it out for my life. I'm not a model for anybody. I'm just telling you what the text says. You ask Jesus to help you by his Spirit and by his community to figure out how to love each other in the middle of it. Everything else is on him. Trust in the Son of God, Jesus the King, and love each other. That's the message we've received from the beginning of time. It has not changed. It will not change. No matter how many times we burst through to a new reality, those two things remain. It's the truth. I hope it encourages you. I hope it binds you up. I pray that it transforms you. I pray that it sanctifies you. I pray that it sustains you all the way to the very end. And when you meet the end, I pray that it resurrects you to eternal life. Because the message of the gospel is Jesus himself. And this is what he promises. Amen? And I would say good luck, but I don't know how else to may God go with you on the journey, because it's really hard. Jesus kind of told us that. Honestly, guys, I don't have fancy words anymore for this stuff. Like, eucatastrophe is a really fancy word, but a cross is still a freaking cross. And death is still death, and suffering is still suffering, and it's still the way. There's no way around that. So, Michael, come bail me out.